Good afternoon, everyone. I call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:30 p.m. on Thursday, February 9th. Please remember to silence your cell phones as a courtesy. We're meeting in the Butrovich Room, room 205 in the Capitol. Committee members present today are Senator Dunbar, Senator Geisel, Senator Tobin, myself, Senator Wilson. We are expecting Senator Kaufman, but we do also have a quorum to conduct business today. This afternoon, we have two items on the agenda. First, we will finish up and take questions from the department on Senate Bill 45, Direct Healthcare Agreement, which we heard and took introduction and also took in public and invited testimony on the bill on Tuesday. Members have some questions related to Medicaid from the Department of Health. Then we will go on to our second piece of business, which is Senate Bill 58, Medicaid Eligibility for Postpartum Mothers, which is sponsored by the Office of the Governor, sponsored through the Senate Rules Committee. With that, we will call up, I believe, Deputy Commissioner Emily Ritchie and her, whoever else you may want to bring as lifeline. And if you guys can put yourselves on the record, and we can begin with questions from there. And also for the record, we were joined by Senator Kaufman.
Senator Wilson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health, and I'm here with Renee Gayhart, Director of Healthcare Services.
And for the record, Senator Wilson, my name is Renee Gayhart, Director of Healthcare Services.
Thank you. I believe we had a question from Senate Bill 45, which dealt with, I remember the conversation here, that dealt with a little bit more why this bill did not include Medicaid, and sort of if you can just go over the differences between Medicaid and Medicare. You know, one's for over a certain age, and the other ones may have more of an income eligibility or condition eligibility, and just go into the sort of the nuances of Medicaid related to Senate Bill 45, which is the act relating to insurance, relating to direct health care agreements, and relating to unfair trade practices.
Again, for the record, my name is Renee Gayhart, Director of Healthcare Services. So I'll start with the Medicare and Medicaid component. So Medicare is not a needs-based program. It's funded fully by the federal government, and it's based on age 65 and then also certain conditions. So with Medicare, the recipient actually pays some co-pays, deductibles, and premiums. But with Medicaid, we are a fully needs-based program and jointly funded by the feds, and the state pays a portion of that. All services are, I think your other question was payer of last resort. And so that comes into play. I didn't have time to send you the videos, the PowerPoints, but I can hand it out later. Medicaid basically coordinates benefits, and so we end up being the payer of last resort in all cases. So what that means is any other liability that's out there goes first and Medicaid comes last. So that can be anything from workman's comp, other group insurances, other liabilities, even in cases of any court-ordered liabilities. So what happens is we chase those pay first, and then Medicaid pays last. The only thing that comes after Medicaid is IHS services. So we are the payer of last resort in all cases. So when we looked at this bill, actually, it goes back to CMS, actually, with the inability to add direct contracting. They did a project, an innovative project, probably in 2020, and they allowed Medicare to enter these direct or Medicare recipients to enter these agreements, because in that case, the recipient is paying that deductible and that premium, and so there's an advantage for that recipient to receive that service through that contract. With Medicaid, because we are the payer of last resort, that doesn't apply, and so CMS also, in this scenario, when CMS approved it for Medicare, they approved it on a limited basis for managed care states, and Alaska is a full fee-for-service state. So CMS doesn't allow direct contracting models as of yet.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Are there questions? Senator Dunbar.
Well, actually, is there more to this presentation? I think my questions on Medicaid are a little bit different issue.
Taking at ease. We are back on the record. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I had some conversations with some primary care physicians about this bill, and one of them expressed some concerns around, essentially a number of offices have a mix of people on Medicaid and people who maybe are a little bit wealthier and might be able to do these direct this direct care. And Medicaid, of course, they're explicitly removed. But my understanding is that there is sort of a shortage, or at least it's difficult to find offices and doctors willing to accept Medicaid at this point, or that there are fewer than we would like folks that would accept Medicaid. Their concern was that folks would leave those kind of mixed offices and some of the patients and go to offices that were doing this direct care model, and leave some of the offices only accepting Medicaid, and it really wouldn't be financially sustainable for them. So sort of skimming off the top, sort of some of the slightly wealthier patients. And so my question is, in other states that have done this, is there any experience of that? Are we worried that, and then those other offices, by the way, being forced to no longer accept Medicaid and changing their business model. Are we worried about this bill directly or indirectly leading to a reduction in number of offices that accept Medicaid?
Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. I don't know the answer to that right now, but we will take it back and look at other states. I will say in general, it's always hard to predict how utilization will shift and how providers will change their business practices for any new type of payment system that occurs, or really any delivery system that happens. When I think about how the point that Director Gayhart made about how other states may have leveraged programs like this for their Medicaid beneficiaries, again, the point about those being states with managed care, I think, is really important, particularly in this context, because I think when you're talking about these direct care services for individuals outside of the Medicaid program, it may make a lot of sense. When you're talking about making opportunities like that available to individuals that are part of the Medicaid program, I think that's where we're at the point where you would look to the department to develop a new program or an innovation model or something like that that can make those opportunities available to the entire beneficiary within the rules of the Medicaid program. And that's a little bit different than what this bill contemplates. But in my mind, I think about how you would establish some sort of direct care agreement that you would be able to leverage for Medicare recipients. In my mind, that would occur through a programmatic demonstration project at this point in terms of how our state Medicaid system is set up on a fee-for-service rather than an individual Medicaid participant agreement, which is really what the direct bill contemplates.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yes, thank you for that. Yes, Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess my ask for you, and I think this is what you said you might be able to provide for the committee, is in states that have allowed this to go forward, and probably use the states you think are most analogous to Alaska, which I understand there aren't many, but if there's, get as close as you can. I'm not sure who it would be, Montana or whoever. And in those states, has this, a bill like this one, had an appreciable impact on the number of doctors that accept Medicaid? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Geisel.
So let me just clarify what you just shared, okay? So first of all, we care for seniors, right? Mm-hmm. We aid pregnant women and children, which has now been expanded to men. Okay, but we aid children, we care for seniors. So my understanding is that because Alaska is fee-for-service, there's no copay mandated for a Medicaid patient being seen. So why? So, but for Medicare, Medicare is a program that the provider opts into or not. Mm-hmm. And if the provider has opted out of Medicare, they can offer direct care services to a senior citizen over age 65. True? Okay. So this direct care model actually will fill a critical gap in Anchorage right now with Alaska Regional Hospital's senior care clinic closing because we care for seniors, right? I think it's getting here in Alaska, Medicaid pays a higher reimbursement than Medicare, which is why people, providers, typically steer away from senior care. For one thing, they're much more complex. They're older, right? Chronic conditions. And the reimbursement is extremely low. So I'm just not sure that there's actually a risk of Medicaid patients rushing over to a direct care clinic when they're not having to pay anyway. So I think the question is kind of confusing. Just saying. I just wanted to clarify. Really, this direct care type program benefits seniors because most healthcare professionals have opted out of Medicare. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you for that, Senator Geisel, for that. Any other questions for the bill sponsor or for the department while they're here answering Medicaid questions? We also have Peter Demar, the attorney, on questions too. All right, seeing none, I just want to say thank you for the department. And at this time, we will set an amendment deadline for this bill for Tuesday the 14th. If you do have an amendment, that doesn't mean amendments have to be drafted or ready by Ledge Legal at the time. That they just please notify that you turned it into Ledge Legal, notify our office so we can do further planning and scheduling for the next time this bill may come up for committee. All right, Senator Geisel.
Mr. Chairman, one of the physicians that offers this kind of services is in the audience. Can we not hear from him? Is this not public testimony as well? Or you closed public testimony?
Yes. But if we have questions for...
I would think it would be beneficial to hear from.
That is perfectly fine.
Okay.
Want to place yourself on the record and tell us who you are and who you represent.
For the record, my name is Wade Erickson. I'm with Capstone Family Medicine in Wasilla.
Thank you, Dr. Erickson. Senator Geisel.
Sure. I just thought it would be helpful to hear what your rationale was for wanting to offer this kind of service, where you think the benefit will be, what risks there might be.
Certainly. So, currently, about 44 states in the country offer this opportunity for patients and providers, and it's been highly successful in those states in increasing access, especially for the underinsured, small businesses, individuals who don't quite meet either the income thresholds for their Medicaid in their states or have enough money to purchase a plan on the individual market. And so my patients, I've known about this system for a number of years. I had seen it working and decided to try to bring it to Alaska. But in consultation with my legal team, determined that it probably, even though it's not expressly prohibited, that it may fall into some of the Title 21 regulations. And so rather than with a larger practice, rather than starting a service line that falls in a gray area, we decided to sort of hit it head on and come straight to the legislature and see if we can't make an exemption for this type of an agreement. So that's been a couple of year process, and we've become much more educated in the meantime. I do see a lot of people now, since I've been putting this forward, coming to me and asking me, when's it going to be available? I'm a contractor. I'm a restaurant owner. I'd like to provide some healthcare for my employees. Maybe they're part-time employees. Maybe they're seasonal employees. But I'd like to provide something for them in order to retain them, to provide, to care for them. And it's far cheaper if I provide a catastrophic plan, insurance plan with this DPC option than it would be if I were to go on to the insurance market per se. And so it's spurred me to expend the time and the effort and money to try to bring this to our state. And I'm hoping and praying that this will be an option for us. There are a lot of caveats. There are a lot of individual circumstances that come up. There's a million ways that people get their health care, pay for their health care. This is just another way that will add a cadre of patients to the quote-unquote more affordably assured, insured population.
Thank you, Dr. Erickson. Senator Giesel.
Thank you. So, Doctor, could you talk about what benefits there might be for seniors? I'm particularly concerned about our seniors, particularly in Anchorage.
Yeah, there's obviously a big need for primary care for senior citizens in Anchorage and the Anchorage municipality. And this would allow, is permissible with Medicare. If you are not a Medicare enrolled provider, you could provide a service like this to a Medicare recipient. If you are a Medicare enrolled provider, you don't have that opportunity yet. But as Director Gayhart was saying, this is something that a pilot project may be amenable to in the near future, and other states are doing that. I do think it's a good idea, but for the time being, you would have to be a non-enrolled provider in order to be able to provide that care. But it does open up another avenue for seniors who would have the means to pay for something like that, to be able to get care. And that's a fair number of people in Anchorage. Not all of them, but a fair number.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for joining us. I have two questions that are unrelated to each other. The first is, you mentioned that this might be an opportunity for employers who want to provide additional levels of care for their employees that may not be able to because they're purchasing a catastrophic plan. However, the legislation doesn't necessarily allow for a business to negotiate the plan. That would be an individual who would negotiate that direct care agreement. So do you anticipate employers having multiple different agreements that they pay the periodic fee for? Or is this one where you think that they will negotiate collectively together and then present it to their employer?
The way that it works practically is that the employer would come in and speak to the provider and say, I've got this many patients that would be interested in enrolling in your program. And we would like to pay for those employees to be able to access you. So it's not a collective group of individuals per se. It's usually the HR department of a small company or the owner of a small company that would come and offer this to their employees, and then they can choose whether to enroll or not based on what their needs are in their family.
Senator Tobin, I have an entity in my district that's a behavioral health provider who does that for their employees. They don't offer health insurance, but instead they sort of offer a cash benefit for healthcare. Now, obviously, the employee can use it for whatever they would like to, but they do offer, I think it's like $6,000 a year for healthcare related needs as a incentive package for employment instead of offering healthcare insurance.
Yeah, I've done that myself as well, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
Well, then, and then a follow-up. This gets me to the question of prescription coverage. So I'm an employee. I have a catastrophic plan. We're negotiating a direct care agreement. I want to negotiate the option to have provided birth control or have provided my asthma medication. How would I go about doing that to make sure that it was affordable for me?
In this instance, direct health plans can be a wide variety of things. You could contract with a pharmacy if you wanted to, theoretically. You could contract with a behavioral health provider, primary care provider, dentist, optometrist, whatever it may be. This is a very vague bill from that perspective, intentionally so. If you're looking at a primary care provider, for instance, then you may look for one that has a generic drug prescription benefit. And there, I think Dr. Umber alluded to that at the last hearing. Not everybody's going to have that. And so you may choose or not choose that particular provider based on their ability to have that prescription plan. There are organizations in the lower 48 that are working to combine drug benefits with direct primary care in a separate type of add-on type service. But generally speaking, for most providers, they don't offer the medication. They give a prescription that goes to the pharmacy, and from there you have to figure out how you're going to pay for it, which is oftentimes something that I, as a provider, engage with my patients on how they're going to pay for the medicines, and I choose the medicines that are going to be affordable and available. There's shortages in certain medicines, okay, so I'm going to pick a different one. This one's too expensive, I'm going to pick a different one. And luckily we have a lot of those options, but frequently when you buy health insurance, you pick your, if it's a comprehensive plan, you pick your plan based on the deductible, the coverages, out-of-pocket, and then does it have vision, dental, eye, does it have a drug prescription coverage that has a certain tiered level of medications that you may buy that are copay free or all the way up to 100% pay. And so you're going to, as an employer or as an individual for that matter, pick the plan that fits what you need for your individual situation that matches the best. And so it won't be a one-size-fits-all, most likely. And but most of the direct primary care, which is the most numerous paradigm in the lower 48, most of those guys are getting pretty smart about figuring out how to offer the top 100 drugs that they prescribe in a generic fashion in order to improve patient health compliance and outcomes. So I think as the market develops itself, you'll see that type of relationship happening. There's always going to be issues with cancer drugs and with some of these high-end autoimmune disease medications, things like that. You're going to need insurance that covers that sort of thing. The vast majority of people, fortunately, don't. So this would be something that would fit more along that lines.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Dr. Erickson? Seeing, I just want to say thank you again for being here and taking the opportunity to come up to answer a few of our community's questions.
I appreciate being heard, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With that, just a reminder again, amendments are due to Ledge Legal by 5 o'clock on close at the 14th, Tuesday, and please notify our office so we can be prepared to receive those and to move on with our committee schedule. Our next piece of business before us is Senate Bill 58, Postpartum Medicaid Extension, by the Office of the Governor. At this time, we'll go ahead and ask our Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Ann Zink, and our Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health, Emily Ritchie, to come up before us. If you could just do a little pause at the end of each slide, and remember that you are switching in between presenters since we have two female voices for records to be a little bit easier. If you guys could just remember to restate yourselves for the record. And with that, you may begin when ready.
Great. For the record, I'm Dr. Ann Zink. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska, and it's a true honor to be able to present this bill to you today. This is postpartum Medicaid coverage, and this is an extension, and we'll kind of go through the different parts of the bill and why we think it will help Alaskans, and then look forward to your questions. So for this bill, I want to highlight kind of three main points that it's going to do. The first thing that this bill is going to do, it's going to help to simplify Medicaid pregnancy coverage so that an eligible mom has health insurance for the first year after she gives birth. aligning her coverage, oftentimes to her child's coverage, instead of just the 2 months after birth and having her reapply and potentially lose insurance during that time, which is a critical time in life both for her as well as her family. Two, this takes a major step in addressing rising maternal mortality rates here in Alaska. And three, this sets a trajectory for Alaska. Our future is our people, and there's no more critical, cost-effective time in life to invest in health than during pregnancy and in early childhood. This critical window sets the course for a person's life, and this bill helps to set the course for our future. So I'm going to start with a few definitions. First of all, I'm going to start with the definition of what is postpartum. So postpartum is the time after birth for a newborn. It's, quote, when a physiological changes in pregnancy return to the non-pregnant state. For many years, this was thought to be somewhere between 6 to 8 weeks after someone gave birth, and why the current coverage goes for that first 60 days. But most health organizations, including the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, now define the period as the first year after birth, given additional research and data that changes in health impacts after birth extend really for that first full year after someone's given birth. Second, we just talked about a little bit about Medicaid and Medicare, but Medicaid provides low-income Alaskans access to health care with supported federal match. Currently, pregnant women qualify for Medicaid for the first 60 days after pregnancy, and as mentioned before, must reapply. Currently, 51% of all births in Alaska are covered by Medicaid. Essentially, this is an evidence-based bill that supports Alaskan families to provide early care and improve maternal health as well as health and child outcomes. Looking at slide 4, I want to highlight the United States is the only developed country in the world where we're seeing maternal mortality rates not only increasing, but much worse than other countries. So this looks at the number of maternal deaths per 100,000 live births. And you can see New Zealand, Norway, Netherlands, we're about like 1.7, 1.8, 3 deaths per 100,000. Well, in the U.S., unfortunately, we're seeing 17.4 deaths per 100,000 live births. And unfortunately, both here in Alaska, we're starting to see an increase. Here in Alaska, as well as the country as a whole, we're seeing an increase. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about what we're seeing specifically in the states. Pregnancy-related deaths occur well beyond that first 60-day postpartum period. About 30% of pregnancy-related deaths in the U.S., if you exclude things like accidents, homicides, and suicides, occur in that later window. And this data specifically looked at 43 to 365 days. But we also know that deaths are only just the tip of the iceberg. For every pregnancy-related death, there is an additional 70 to 80 cases of severe maternal illness and morbidity associated in the postpartum. So this is just, again, the death is just a very small component of this. Medicaid-enrolled women are especially vulnerable to pregnancy-related conditions. They're more likely to experience chronic conditions, preterm and low birth weights, as well as severe maternal morbidity. Diving in a bit deeper into Alaska-specific data, here you can see that, unfortunately, Alaska's been seeing similar trends to what we've seen in the U.S. as a whole, with increasing rates of maternal mortality, both in rural and urban Alaska. If you look at the 5-year past average, we've seen an increase in 109% in maternal mortality. But I would like to highlight that, unfortunately, we are seeing a faster escalation in our rural area with 184% increase in maternal mortality. We're seeing increasing discrepancies and disparities in rural versus urban healthcare. We are seeing an increase in urban as well, but that's been at a slower rate at 64%. Among the deaths that occurred between 2015 and 2019, 73% occurred in that greater than 6-week postpartum. So that's looking at all deaths that had occurred in that first year after birth. 73% occurred later in there. And among the deaths that were reviewed by Alaska's Maternal, Child, and Death Review Committee during 2016 and 2018, 88% were considered potentially preventable, and 44% were associated with barriers to healthcare access, which this bill directly attempts to address. I would also like to note for the record that we do have a couple of our team members online who've been happy to take more of those questions. But for that, I'm going to hand over the next 2 slides to DC Ricci.
Before you do, Dr. Zink, and the 2 folks you do have online are Rebecca Morsey, the chief section chief for the Women's Children's Health and Family Health for the Department of Health, and also Dr. Michelle Nass, the pediatric physician for the Women's, Children's, and Family Health for the Department of Health. Sorry. I just want to mention, and I know you talked a little bit about that, but you didn't really drive home on some of the sort of the national data on why some of the Medicaid women that are enrolled are more expected, but a lot of this, especially in the rural Alaska, is that people, minorities, have sort of a health disparity, and you didn't really touch upon that. Or do you have data to talk a little bit about that later on in this presentation? Or just that you can provide the committee a later time?
Yeah, Senator Wilson, the chair, we'd be happy to provide more data, but we definitely see maternal mortality has a large racial, ethnic, as well as geographic discrepancy. So we see African American, Black Americans, Alaska Native people are at much higher risk for maternal mortality. We also see that urban Alaskans are less likely to be affected and rural Alaskans are more likely to be affected. We do have for the committee and provided within here a summary of our maternal death review, and we're happy to provide additional data on that. I don't have additional slides on this presentation specifically on that, but happy to kind of go into more questions or provide additional information to the committee afterwards.
Thank you. Please continue.
Good afternoon. For the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. So I appreciate Dr. Zink kind of painting the picture of why the current coverage doesn't necessarily align with the needs that we've identified and that are emerging for mothers around the state and in the United States. So we're not the only ones that are noticing this and paying attention to this. In 2020, with the passage of the American Rescue Act, Section 9812 allowed basically a time-limited option that said, okay, states, we know that currently the minimum is 60 days. We are going to allow you to extend postpartum coverage up to 12 months, and we're going to allow you to do that through 2027. And this was kind of the initial way for the federal government to make it fairly easy for states to extend that postpartum coverage from 60 days to 12 months, but in a time-limited fashion. Now, what changed is relatively recently, in December of 2022, federal legislation, specifically the Consolidated Appropriation Act, actually revised that ARPA, or that prior federal statutory authority, to make that optional coverage extension permanent. So no longer having that end or terminate in 2027, but actually be a permanent option that states could adopt. And, you know, we are often asked, how can we change Medicaid? And our response is that it's complicated. It is a shared federal and state program, and there are lots of different rules that have to occur in order to make any changes. This is really the federal government's way of trying to make it as easy as possible for states to adopt this extension and to provide that additional coverage. So for us, this was really an important indication to states that from the federal government's perspective, this is important coverage that has demonstrated value, and they are making it as easy as possible for states to adopt and implement that. So why are we here? Why do we need a legislative bill in order to implement this? Well, as outlined in Alaska statute, the legislature must approve all optional groups for Medicaid coverage through 4707020. So this means that before we can extend this coverage from 60 days to 12 months, we need to have statutory authority to do that, which is what this bill does. Women who are eligible for Medicaid in Alaska based on their pregnancy currently only receive coverage for 60 days postpartum. After that period, there may be other criteria that they are eligible for to continue their Medicaid coverage, but they do experience that change or that transition after 60 days. And that's significant because in Alaska, 51% of births are covered through Medicaid. So the Medicaid program covers a disproportionate share of total births. And I don't know if Dr. Zink, you want to add anything to this?
Yeah, no, I just appreciate this. This is a really, again, for the record, this is Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer for the state of Alaska. We have not seen CMS offer an option like this before. In general, we have to go to the federal government and say this is the way that we need to change our services, our SPA amendment, or we have to do a demonstration waiver like the 1115. But the data was so compelling on making sure that women in this postpartum period did not lose coverage that the federal government offered us this option, offered all states this option. And checking the numbers with states, I feel like it's a little bit like checking COVID numbers these days. I checked again right prior to coming in. Yesterday when I checked, it was 29 states. I just saw that 35 states. So this is as legislation is going through, we're seeing a lot of states, including Washington, D.C., have now opted to extend this postpartum coverage given the significant benefit that it provides to their families. I'm going to talk a little bit more, again, this is again Dr. Ann Zink, Chief Medical Officer for the state of Alaska, about what really that we see for the benefits for Alaska and, again, why this is important. So we've talked about preventing these gaps in healthcare coverage. I know as a mom myself, 2 months in, I felt like it went very fast, yet very slow. and insurance paperwork was maybe not the top thing on my mind as I was trying to figure out everything from breastfeeding to childcare to what my life looked like at that time. And so this helps to reduce one bureaucratic additional burden for a critical point in life. Two, we see data that improves maternal mental health. So the diagnosis of postpartum depression can't even begin to be made until at least 6 weeks after birth. There's just a lot of changes that happen during that period. So that only gives a mother really a couple of weeks from that time when they could be diagnosed to even begin to get services in that space. We do see that mental health conditions contribute to 31% of pregnancy-associated deaths in Alaska when we look in 2014 to 2018. And 14% of Alaska mothers who had a baby in 2020 had symptoms of postpartum depression. So it's not a small number, and it's a critical number to support those moms during that time. And again, I am mentioning pregnancy-associated deaths here, and we see a really high burden of morbidity associated with things like mental health and depression that can be treated. Addressing those disparities, as Chair Wilson mentioned previously, Medicaid plays a vital role in addressing disparities in maternal mortality and morbidity rates. And this we see increasing rates, particularly among Alaska Native people, as well as in our rural communities. And therefore, this is a real attempt to try to help address this as well. And then the last thing I want to mention is improving childhood outcomes. So parental enrollment in Medicaid is associated with a 29% higher probability that the child receives well annual child visits, and that's regardless of the child's coverage. And so when a parent, when a mom is covered, they're more likely to bring their child in for well child visits, which is critical in that first year of life to make sure that they are getting a good, healthy start to the beginning of their future. Another question that we get asked often is cost savings. Providing the cost for Medicaid coverage to new mothers really helps to help prevent what we would see in gaps of coverage and potentially more expensive health care in other sets, going to the emergency department, waiting till chronic conditions present later, showing up suicidal rather than getting mental health care earlier. When we looked at and when the country looked at how we would avert savings for maternal mortality, Medicaid-enrolled pregnant women with severe maternal morbidity costs average about $10,000 annually compared to just over $6,000 without. So we see women who have higher maternal morbidity are more expensive than healthy moms within the system. And that savings is primarily from prevention. But prevention is hard to calculate. So the fiscal bill really can't take into account the prevention. But the reason the federal government has put this forward as an option is because looking at much larger studies, the prevention and cost savings is clear. Prevention gaps in coverage ensure access to primary care and preventative care, including management of chronic conditions, screening for mental health conditions, substance use, as well as intimate partner violence. There is large national support as well as support within Alaska for this bill, and here's a series of organizations that have nationally come out in support of this overall. And this fits in with the governor's Healthy Families Initiative. When looking at the Healthy Families Initiative, there's three major pillars: healthy beginnings, healthcare access, and healthy communities. This one really fits within that healthy beginnings, but I would also suggest that it also has to do with healthcare access as well as healthy communities, and why this is a bill that you see from the governor as this key founder, cornerstone of the Healthy Families Initiative, in combination with some additional work that he's putting forward as this four-year state initiative to try to make Alaska the best place to raise a family. I will hand it now over to DC Ritchie to talk a little bit about sexual analysis.
Good afternoon. For the record, this is Emily Ritchie, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. So we're going to walk through a sectional analysis. There are four sections. I really always avoid trying to use the word simple to describe anything in healthcare or Medicaid, but this is as simple as possible. So the first section basically authorizes the department to implement this extension from 60 days to 12 months. Specifically, the language used is coverage up to the maximum period authorized under federal law, which would be 12 months. The next section, Section 2, amends the law to basically require the department to submit a Medicaid state plan amendment. That is how we communicate with the federal government to say these are the services that will be offered to these individuals in this way. And so before this can be added to the program, we do have to submit a state plan amendment or a SPA and basically have the federal government, CMS, sign off on that. So this would direct us to do that. Section 3 requires that the Commissioner of Health notifies the revisor of statutes 30 days after the federal government or CMS has approved that state plan amendment. So basically, we have worked with CMS. We have they have approved our state plan amendment. We can move forward. We're going to communicate that to the revisor of statutes, And then Section 4 establishes that that extension takes effect the day after the commissioner notifies the revisers of statutes that that spot has been approved by CMS.
For the record, this is Dr. Ann Zink, and we just wanted to end with a final story and a final comment. I have the great fortune of being able to see patients clinically in the emergency department still, and recently saw a woman who had been really struggling with postpartum depression and after the birth of her child, and previously she had used alcohol to cope with her depression, and she started to drink quite significantly again. She had lost her coverage, and it got to the point that she didn't feel like she could access any other care. Her husband became increasingly concerned and ended up bringing her into the emergency department after drinking extensively for quite a significant period of time. In the emergency department, we were able to get her services, also helped to try to re-enroll her in Medicaid, but she had lost that gap in coverage, so she wasn't able to follow up with her primary. She wasn't able to get care. We helped to re-enroll her, gave her services, and unfortunately, in the emergency department, sometimes we can become skeptical. We see a lot of really hard stories over and over again, and we don't oftentimes see the good outcomes. And she went on her way, and that was the last time I thought I had seen her, until a couple weeks ago when she came back into the emergency department with her small child who had fallen and had a little minor bump and was totally fine. And I did a double take seeing her. And she smiled, and she said, because I was able to get services, I am completely clean. I am sober. I am here for my child. I'm here to care for her, and I am thriving in this space. And this just highlighted, again to me, the critical time period that this is for families and for children to being able to move forward and why we brought this bill forward. I want to say that when we build a house, we invest in our foundation. And when we build a future, we invest in our families. And that's what we hope to do with this bill. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there questions for the presenters? Senator, I keep on calling everyone a doctor. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair. With respect to the fiscal note, I'm just interested in how the basis was developed. So the quantity of 1,596 and just how that was established. I'm sure it's data driven, but I just would appreciate having that on the record. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman. This is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Health. So that fiscal note was established by looking at data from 2018, which determined that a total of about almost 3,600 postpartum, like pregnant women or women who were in that postpartum period, either lost or experienced a gap in coverage between that 60-day and that 12-month period in the Medicaid program. 1,600 of those women, about 1,600, experienced a total loss of coverage, meaning that when they were looking back at the data, they were never reinstated in the Medicaid program, and about 2,000 experienced a gap at some point between the 60-day period and that 12-month period. And so assuming that the average cost per month per beneficiary was about $566, and kind of doing the proportion over that extended 10-month period, that's kind of the underlying assumptions behind that fiscal note. And I would add, because this is always important, is that this group currently receives a federal match, what we call the FMAP, so the ratio between total cost, what the federal government pays and what the state pays, is 56.2% for this group. So all of that was taken into consideration when calculating the fiscal note.
Thank you, Paula.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Dunbar, then Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you had mentioned we're seeing a rising, unfortunately, a rising postpartum mortality rate and morbidity rate. I don't think you sort of explained why. Do we have any sense of why this is happening? It's clearly a national trend, but it's worsened in Alaska, particularly in rural Alaska. So what has changed in the last 5 years, you think, that is driving this worsening trend?
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I will hit on a couple highlights there, but then I would invite some of our guests because they are also on these committees and doing a deeper dive. I would state that just from the beginning, it's multifactorial. There's many, many reasons for this. So I am looking at death categorizations between 2015 and 2019, and this was done within Alaska. We saw 7 suicides, 7 drug and alcohol deaths, 8 homicides and assaults, 8 unintentional injuries. we saw 9 pregnancy-related medical causes and 9 other mortality rate causes. So we see a lot of what we call deaths of despair, suicide, drug overdose, homicide are components of what we're talking about. We see that 88% were considered potentially preventable, as I mentioned before. We saw alcohol use and drug use as substance use disorders were documented in 72% of the cases. 71% of the decedents had a history of being a victim or a possible victim of interpersonal violence. 44% of the deaths were associated with barriers to healthcare access. 17% were pregnant at the time of their death. 6 occurred within 7 days of postpartum delivery. 4 occurred between the 8 and 42 days of delivery, and 73% occurred greater than 42 days. And I'm happy to make copies of this sheet for the committee with additional data on it. But then, if it's okay through the chair, I'd welcome Becky Morrissey to potentially provide any additional national data.
Ms. Morrissey, are you online?
Yes, I am here. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar, I would just add on to what Dr. Zing said. We're also, you know, seeing increases in just chronic disease overall, and just substances and the mental health crisis that we're facing, and intimate partner violence as well. I do think the fact sheet that Dr. Zing is referencing covers a lot of this, but we're certainly happy to provide more. Thank you.
Thank you. And I believe that is uploaded in part of the packet that was that's out there and upload to BASIS. And Ms. Morrissey, if you can place yourself on the record.
This is Rebecca Morrissey. I'm the Section Chief for Women's, Children's, and Family Health.
Thank you so much. Senator, any follow-up? Senator Dunbar?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just briefly, the fact sheet sort of describes the deaths of 72% drug alcohol related and 71% are interpersonal violence related, but it doesn't describe sort of what. Was that also the case back in 2012 when the rates were lower? Was the percentage the same? You know, but I think that it was just answered that we've seen an increase in substance use disorders. We've seen an increase in the sort of mental health problems. Now, the next question, which you probably can't answer, is well, why? Why are we seeing more mental health problems? Why are we seeing more substance abuse issues? That's not something we're going to resolve just with this bill, but thank you very much for bringing it forward. This is a really interesting and I think very necessary piece of legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Giesel.
Sure. I wanted to ask about the time frame for actual implementation. So, Ms. Ritchie, you talked about submitting a SPA. How long does it take you to develop that document? And then you said CMS would approve it. What's the lag time between you submitting it and CMS approving?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel. For the record, this is Emily Ricci, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Health. You know, I think realistically, after this passes, you're probably looking at the earliest probably 12 months, because not only the SPA process is long and it requires a lot of deliberation and a lot of public, not just deliberation on CMS's part, but also a public process where there's opportunities for tribal consultation, there's opportunities for public comment. So that process can take anywhere from like 6 months to 18 months, honestly, depending on the complexity of the question that's being asked. This is relatively simple, so I would look towards the shorter end of that. But, you know, the department is also going to have to promulgate regulations to support this as well. And so sometimes, again, depending on the topic, those regulations can occur before the SPA, after the SPA, or at the same time. And I anticipate that we would try to promulgate regulations around the same time that we're moving the SPA forward, just to try to streamline this and make it as efficient as possible. But you're really looking at a 12-month to 18-month time period between when we have authorization to pursue this and when it actually takes effect.
Thank you. That's significant. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions for our presenters, I just want to say thank you. Please stick around as we get ready to open up public testimony. Open up public testimony. We do have a few folks here in the room in Juneau. We'll first start with Ms. Brooke Ivey from the Alaska Children's Trust, followed by Morgan Lim. And I guess we have some time, so we can do 3 minutes for testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Brooke Ivey, Vice President of Policy and Advocacy for the Alaska Children's Trust. As a reminder, the Alaska Children's Trust, or ACT, is the statewide lead organization on the prevention of child abuse and neglect. As we talk about this bill extending postpartum Medicaid coverage to 12 months, we couldn't align more with the mission of this. This is what primary prevention looks like and what we see as really how we're going to resolve child abuse and neglect cases in the state. So this is just one example. As you've heard, it will give moms, new mothers, time to deal with these post-birth health complications. Postpartum depression is one key one. As you've heard, research shows it's associated with an array of negative outcomes, decreased child safety practices, reduced emotional and developmental opportunities with the mother for the child, decrease in health checkups, which means that they could be missing these key developmental milestones, and that bonding difficulty between mother and child, which is a primary predictor of child abuse. So in Alaska, we know that 41% of child abuse and neglect cases are for children aged birth to four, and the highest risk is zero, birth to age one. So this is a critical time, as you've heard. And so in addition to, creating that opportunity to address postpartum depression, of course, reduces the maternal mortality rates, ensuring mothers are alive and healthy to raise their children, of course. And then we also feel that this help protects new parents from medical debt in the first year, which can really reduce that financial stress that can also be a factor in child abuse and neglect. According to the National Kids Count Program, Alaska ranks 44th in the nation for health. So any steps that we can take to increase and health outcomes for our children and our families, we are in full support, and this is certainly one of those. So with that, we're just excited to see Alaska join the nearly three quarters of other states who have extended postpartum coverage, and we're in full support and appreciate you taking the time to hear our testimony today. So thank you.
Thank you. Next for public testimony, Morgan Lim.
Thank you, Chair Wilson, and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. For the record, my name is Morgan Lim. I'm a Juneau resident, and today I'm testifying on behalf of Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates Alaska. PPAA is in strong support of SB 58, which would ensure continuity of coverage and care for birthing parents by extending Medicaid postpartum coverage to a full year. Economic inequality, structural racism, and public health failures have all collided and resulted in dire maternal health outcomes for Black and Indigenous people in our country. While Alaska has lower maternal mortality rates than the national average, there are stark racial and geographical disparities in who is impacted most by maternal mortality. Rates are highest among Indigenous parents and those in Southwest Alaska. Right now, American Indian and Alaska Native people are two times more likely to die of pregnancy-related causes than white women, and Black pregnant people are three times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women. Ensuring continuous care that will address the leading causes of complications is essential to significantly reducing maternal mortality rates in the state. One of the most effective ways to improve outcomes for pregnant people is to ensure the continuity of care through 12 months. Research tells us that 33% of maternal deaths occur in the postpartum period, and a significant number of those postpartum deaths occur past 60 days of the currently provided coverage. Ending coverage after 60 days creates an unsafe gap in coverage, which interrupts stable and consistent access to care during this vulnerable time. Since 60% of all pregnancy-related deaths are preventable, expanding comprehensive coverage to all pregnant people for a year postpartum could have a major impact reducing maternal mortality rates. Planned Parenthood believes all people in Alaska deserve to have healthy pregnancies, births, and postpartum periods, and we are glad to see SB 58 taking the steps towards improving maternal health outcomes and addressing disparities. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Anyone else here in the room in Juneau would like to testify? Please come up and state your name and affiliation. You know the team is Monk.
Hello, I'm Jeannie Monk. with the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. I wasn't intending to testify today, but I figured since I'm here, I would just very briefly share comments. We are very supportive of this measure. AHA and our member hospitals work in partnership with the Department of Health on and the Women's, Children's, and Family Unit to reduce severe maternal mortality and morbidity. We are involved with the maternal child health death review process and are looking at the, you know, the causes of the morbidity and mortality, and access to care is a really critical area. So we strongly support this for all the reasons other people have shared. Extending postpartum Medicaid coverage for 12 months is something we've wanted for a long time, and I was thrilled when I saw the governor had introduced this bill as a way to support families and improve care. We have a lot of data, and we have looked at all of the data and really have identified from 2016 through 2022, almost half of the recent maternal deaths were in some way associated with barriers to healthcare access. So not saying that this will change that, but giving people better access to care will certainly help them meet their needs. So we just strongly encourage you to move this forward, given that it will take 12 to 18 months to actually get it in place. The sooner we can get the statute change and begin the process, the better. So thanks for the chance to put our support behind this.
Thank you. Now we're going to go to the phone lines. And for those also listening at home that may want to submit a testimony or a comment on this piece of legislation, public comment can also be submitted to us by email at shss@akleg.gov. And the first one we have online is Casey Consort, followed by Serene. If you can, Casey, put your name and affiliation on the record, and you have 3 minutes for your testimony. Please begin when you're ready.
Thank you. My name is Casey Consort, C-A-S-O-R-T. I'm a Fairbanks resident, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself today. I'm calling in support of SB 58. As Dr. Zink was mentioning, the maternal mortality data that came out fairly recently shows that Alaska's maternal mortality rates are on the rise, and extending Medicaid coverage to 12 months postpartum will help reduce the maternal mortality rate and generally just get us one step closer to reducing those health disparities in our state. I'm really excited to see this bill moving quickly, and I'm hopeful that it will pass both of the legislative bodies this year. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next, we have Serene O'Hara Jolly.
Yes. Hello, my name is Serene O'Hara Jolly, and I live in Anchorage on Dena'ina lands, and I'm representing myself. I am here in support of SB 58, 12 months postpartum coverage, and I thank the Senate committee for prioritizing this bill. I know that others have and will continue to share all of the statistical reasons for the important extension of coverage, one of which is that 60% of all pregnancy-related deaths are preventable. 60% preventable, that is so many mothers and parents getting to love and raise their children. This is a bill that will save lives. 1 month ago, my little sister gave birth to her first child. The birth of this baby has brought so much joy to me and my entire family, but with that depth of love has also come worry of the unknown. As my little sister and baby grow and heal, I have received panicked phone calls and made trips to the hospital and doctors filled with anxiety. In the months since this little baby has joined our family, it has been filled with love, but also uncertainty. My sister has insurance coverage through her husband's job, and so I am here to advocate to make sure that everyone in Alaska who has a baby has the same access to care and coverage, to make sure that they can raise their families happy, healthy, and together. Please pass SB 58 to make sure everyone who gives birth has access to care. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Jamie Morgan. Jamie, if you could state your name and affiliation for the record, and you have 3 minutes to testify, you may begin when you're ready.
Yes, thank you. Good evening. This is Jamie Morgan. I am with the American Heart Association, and we are in strong support of this bill. We recognize the importance of postpartum care and the risk for women that have heart disease, either prior, during, or after birth, and just think that this, thank you all for considering this, and we urge your support. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Seeing no one else online, last call for anyone else in the room here in Juneau. And then we will go ahead and close public testimony. At this time, is there any further questions for the bill sponsor? And do the bill sponsors have any comments they would like to add in closing? All right, Senator Geisel.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, I know that it is customary to have bills heard twice in committee. But this is a very straightforward bill, and it will take 18 months. It'll be the end of 2024 before we actually see this implemented. Mr. Chairman, I would suggest that we could move this today.
Let's take a brief pause. We are back on the record. With that, we just wanted to give a quick overview of the bill, make sure that everything's there, have members have the opportunity. I agree with you, Senator Geisel. This is a very important piece of legislation. All throughout different conferences all throughout last year, my counterparts across the nation have all been looking at this and passing legislation, as we heard, 35 states have already committed legislation and passed legislation. And it was a priority amongst a lot of my colleagues and around the country. So with that, we can set an amendment deadline for the 13th to be into our office by close of business, and hopefully bring this back up before the committees for further consideration on the 14th. Senator Geisel.
Yeah, just a question. So if we amend this, does that change the program? I mean, what would be the purpose of amending, Mr. Chairman? I'm just wondering.
Just if any other member may have issues or just comments that they may want to include or to amend to within the title of the bill. So, with that, any further other comments, closing remarks? Seeing none, what's our next schedule for next week? Next Tuesday, Valentine's Day, we will hear an update from our Citizens Review Panel and the Office of Children's Services. This meeting will be a joint meeting with the House and Human Services next week. And we'll make sure we have a room, either our room or their room, downstairs in 106. And then next Thursday, February 16th, we'll hear introduction of Senate Bill 8, the repeal of Certificate of Need program, sponsored by my office, and a briefing by the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Education. With that, we are adjourned at 4:33 p.m.